This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about drugs and anxiety. We recently covered dual diagnosis with our anxiety and OCD episode, and particularly when we're referring to drugs with addiction, addiction and anxiety are also an incredibly common dual diagnosis. So to start off, we've got a stat from Mind all about how common mental health problems can be. We're all quite used to hearing the one about 1 in 4 people experience mental illness every year, but a more recent stat they've come out with is that in England, 1 in 6 people report experiencing a common mental health problem in any given week. And I thought that was a really good one to highlight there, because it's one thing to think of 1 in 4 a year, but when you think about 1 in 6 every week, that shows you how common and long-term so many people's experience of mental illness is. That it's only in the minority of cases that the people are having one brief experience once in a year and that's it. It's far more common that it's repeating or more long-term.
1 in 6 a week is high. You know, 1 in 6 experience a common mental illness, but also gives me hope that actually there's so many people are dealing with so many things that maybe are more common, maybe like anxiety, and that there's hope that we can do something about that before it then escalates.
And you've really alluded to something that is one of the few positives we can take out of such prevalence, that with such prevalence comes more understanding and the resources have to follow it. So as much as there's underfunding at the moment, the more understanding and demand grows, the more pressure there is for those resources to catch up.
Well, absolutely. And as we spoke about before, I've just had to do some work around safeguarding. And one of the key things that I really wanted to give my talk on was the prevention element. And this comes absolutely into it, like that we need the resource to help prevent. I'm not saying that we can eradicate mental illness, but I think we can prevent and decrease this 1 in 6 figure with just upfront resources. That is safeguarding to me, the prevention, hence our campaign and all the different things, rather than maybe resources just going into aftercare.
Yeah, for sure. And that's particularly relevant for the theme we're doing today of drugs and anxiety, because so often when we talk about drugs, it's addiction. But also in the case of our guest, you'll hear a lot about a mixture of, at times he was using drugs because of addiction, at times it was to kind of self-medicate up to a point and just help him kind of numb out some of the pain of mental illness, but also the drugs were causing anxiety and other mental health problems. And so there's this real intermeshed interaction. And that's why, you know, safeguarding is so key in terms of prevention.
Yeah.
That it's not enough to just have the resources there. It's how can we preempt this? How can we, through education and reduce stigma, help people make safer choices so that they don't go down this kind of spiraling effect of throwing drugs at something they're struggling with and thinking that's not going to create more problems.
Absolutely. I listened to an amazing talk by a gentleman the other day talking about his who's always campaigned for more understanding around cannabis and psychosis and how it really does have an impact.
Because, sorry, I should maybe clarify, specifically with the guest and a lot of what we talk about in the episode, we are talking about illicit substances. We're not talking
about medication.
The drugs you get at the GP.
Yeah, yeah. And after him giving the talk about his son struggling with psychosis after smoking weed, like really intently for like a year, 20 years ago, he's never recovered. He had a big psychotic episode, never recovered. And he gave this talk about it and talking about how more people should know about it. Just being a little bit more aware would reduce it. So again, coming back to education and just helping people understand the effects of drugs was my first point. And my second point, I mean, I've got 50 points, Bobby, but my second point was, interesting when you talk about how difficult is it, this subject, because you take drugs because you're feeling shit. Mm-hmm. Or you're feeling shit because you've been taking drugs. Like, it is just such a combined thing.
Yeah, and it's very difficult to unpick that even years later. And that's something that, speaking to Kyle, he's got so much clarity looking back. It was really difficult for him at the time to pick through where these links were. What was mental illness symptoms? What were effects of drug taking?
Yeah.
And how it all interlocked, because your mind isn't functioning as you'd normally hope it would. And it can cause memory loss on top of that that makes it even more difficult.
Yeah, to figure it out.
To figure out what's going on. And we've got some stats around that as well. So from the UK government, research shows that mental health problems are experienced by the majority, 70%, of drug users in common substance misuse treatment.
I mean, it's so intrinsically linked.
Yeah, absolutely, because if you're experiencing addiction, that's classed as a mental illness anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And as we know from interviewing so many guests, certain conditions tend to sort of attract other conditions.
Yeah.
And addiction is one of those. It may be partly that you're more likely to take drugs for certain reasons if you're struggling with your mind. But also there seems to be these kind of parallels that certain conditions do come up more with certain drug-taking behaviours, anxiety being one such example.
Mm.
There can be naturally a kind of paranoia that can carry over from side effects of drug-taking that can carry over into your day-to-day mental health. And that's why it's so difficult to draw these lines when there's symptom crossovers like this.
And substance abuse crossovers.
Absolutely.
A lot of the research was clouded by alcohol. You have to really strip it away to find just drugs on their own as opposed to alcohol misuse.
Right. And on the flip side, using drugs, misusing alcohol can really affect the kind of treatment you receive.
Mm.
So also from this government research, they highlighted how individuals experiencing mental health crises may also experience difficulty in accessing care due to intoxication. And they've also mentioned there how that's in spite of the heightened risk of harm that intoxication brings. So actually, from a healthcare perspective, that person is more at risk and therefore more in need of care because they're more likely to come to harm to themselves or others or make further choices that could negatively affect their mental health. And yet, when they're intoxicated, they're more likely to
turn away. Less likely to access.
And that's really a difficult one because there are complications there that are difficult to avoid. So some counselling services, for example, will make new clients come in and sign a disclaimer that they're not going to be under the influence when they're going to counselling. But if you're going to counselling partly because of issues around substance misuse, then that's a paradox. How does that work?
Well, I know.
So I can get it from the point of view of the counsellors in that it's going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to work through certain issues while someone's mind is altered by substances. But then at the same time, they still need support. And so maybe there's a gap there for specific types of other support being beefed up, less referrals to counselling, or maybe the specific types of counselling that could be more tailored to that.
Yeah, I think you've made a really good point there, actually, Bobby. You're right. I think there is a gap. Because being referred to counselling, there's all these boxes that need to be ticked. There's hardly any counselling support available. People are waiting for months and months and months on end to even get to see a counsellor. Most counsellors' approach may be CBT or something else, so they've got quite a set agenda in which they counsel you through, therapists or, you know, whatever. And you're right, I think that gap, you know, where people might just want to go, and I've not really worked with anybody with drug or alcohol abuse, but I can imagine, even as a coach, how difficult it is, because you even expect people to come in with a clear mind, even if they're not misusing alcohol or any substances, ready to talk, ready to connect. And that can be difficult from somebody who doesn't ever touch alcohol or drugs, let alone working with somebody who is misusing substances.
Right. That's such a great point, because for many people, them coming into counselling in tears is a reflection of how their mental health is. For other people, them coming in under the influence is a reflection of how their mental health is. There's complications either way but we still need to find ways to offer the support. Because otherwise you keep the coping mechanisms. As much as drug programs are incredibly transformative, it's not a coincidence that they try and bring in mental health aspects wherever possible, not just how can we get this person out of the habit of drug taking, but also how can we get them to learn healthier coping mechanisms so they're not going to just go back to this for another reason. And so the final thing I wanted to finish up with is some stats from the Mental Health Foundation, just to highlight how common drug dependence can be in the UK. So they found 3.1% of adults show signs of drug dependence, and that's 4.3% of men and 1.9% of women.
Mm.
So a little bit like we talked about in last week's episode, there is that disparity of the genders. And yeah. I do wonder, again, if it's partly to do with men accessing support later when they're potentially further down the line and more ill.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of man up culture might also contribute to you thinking, okay, well, I'm going to take a bit of this as opposed to speaking up about how I feel. I'm going to try and numb out, because really, that's what man up means, doesn't it? It doesn't mean man up and go seek support.
No.
It means
man up and
push everything down.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't mean deal with it, does it?
Well,
it
no, just get on with it is what I mean.
Because for me, a powerful reflection of someone being their best self as a human, let alone male or female, would then be looking after their mental health for the sake of themselves, but also those around them, those that care about them. And to me, that is strong. And if we're equating masculinity with strength, well,
absolutely, it is. The bravest thing to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, is bravery and strength not things that as young boys were meant to grow up with? I mean, I was certainly subjected to a lot of that kind of encouragement.
Yeah.
You know, boys don't cry. Boys grow up strong.
For anybody, it's so brave, like so inspirational for the people that do step out and talk about what's going on and seek help. It's so inspirational to me.
Yeah, and we see that with our guests.
I just really mean that, absolutely.
And gender doesn't come into it.
Doesn't.
You know, our guests are inspiring and brave and powerful in owning their truth.
That's exactly what
and
it is.
And that's just a human trait.
Yeah, and we really mean that, don't we? It's like kick ass, like I love it.
Yeah, we love
our guests. We're so connected to the guests, and they're amazing. They really are amazing.
It's not a coincidence that we have so many repeat guests. It's because I'm still chatting to most of them.
I'm in your city. Fancy a coffee? Yeah, let's do it.
It's great. It's wonderful to have this kind of network around the UK. And actually, you've just reminded me of a fun thing we can preview, because as of when this episode goes out, I will be in Edinburgh. And I'm interviewing loads of different performers there. And
yay,
mainly comedians. So that'll be interesting to add a bit of extra humour to our show whilst I'm recording those. And so again, it's a way that we can share how incredible creative people are drawing on their experience of mental illness, life's ups and downs in general, to inform their art and creating something that we can all relate to, we can all find funny, we can all be moved by. I think there's such power to that. And yeah, and now I have even more friends in Edinburgh I can go for.
I know, so exciting. If anybody's in Edinburgh or not, go along to the Fringe and listen to the podcast with all the amazing guests that Bobby's going to be interviewing. I can't wait.
Yeah, look out for a fun mini-series coming in the next few weeks, all about comedy and mental health. And on that fun announcement, we will get into the interview with Kyle, all about drugs and anxiety. It's a side of mental health that I think isn't talked about enough. And I think it will really lift the lid for a lot of people that may not always see how easy it is for certain people to fall into drug taking and other behaviours that can really send them on a dangerous spiral with their mental health. If you've not been exposed to that, it can be very easy to think of that doesn't happen to people like me.
Yeah.
But as you'll hear with our guest, it was very easy for a few things to happen in his life to lead up to him ending up in some really dangerous situations. So we'll get into that in a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hey, my name's Kyle. I am 26 years old, and I would imagine my journey with mental health really started probably coming into primary school. My mum had this image in her mind when she had me and my little brother, which was like, let's, you know, put them in a nice Catholic all-boys school, a private school. And, you know, I'm not saying that I'm ungrateful for any of that. I understood that. But what this actually did was it kind of sheltered me and my little brother for a bit. 10 to 11 years of just, oh, you know, go to church every Friday and this, that and the other. And meanwhile, like, we're living in East Ham. And for the people who aren't familiar with East London, it's a shithole. And then we moved out a little bit because the police were at the end of the road. You know, every day my mum was like, oh, I don't want this life. And she was kind of constructing this life. And I feel like this is a story that will be for a lot of people, especially the parents who have worked their way out of working class and kind of tried to find a better life. But what happened by the time I was year five is they couldn't afford it. My dad lost his contract and I'm there and they don't really take a 9-10 year old seriously. But I'm like, oh, I'll go to the school around the corner. Like, don't be silly. But the reason why that kind of affected it is because living so sheltered, then entering into high school, which wasn't the worst school, don't get me wrong, it was called Wanstead High School. It used to be a grammar school. It was like Wanstead's probably one of the nicest areas in East London. But whereas it's kind of like situated geographically, you had all kinds of people there. And it doesn't even matter who was there in the place. It was more about the fact that I'd been given that little bit more freedom, as most kids do that day. But it wasn't just that. It was like, it's finding everything that you'd been kind of sheltered from, really. And like, all gangs and drugs. And it was hard to, what's the word?
Get used to, like adjust.
Yeah, it was so sporadic. It was just a whole different world to me. And I know that is that way growing up anyway, because you're kind of getting used to social norms and there's still some, you know, moral things, lessons that you're being learned and the whole teenage kind of shebang. But I feel like for me, I was just like, oh, this, that and the other. And I think that's mainly where it started, where it kind of like started to spring from, was what I'm explaining now basically is mania. It's like, oh, I'm so excited about all these new things. And then along the way, realizing the opposite, why I should be depressed about it, you know, because the things happen, you know, you work for certain people, you sell certain things and you get in certain situations and these people aren't friendly. And to be fair, like, I had it okay. Like, some of the stories I've heard of people that I grew around with and things like that had a really tough time. You wouldn't think that some of these stories for, you know, kids getting stabbed up and, you know, CS gas getting thrown into warehouses of raves, like, You don't expect it when you're 13, 14. When you start hearing about it at the time, you just normalise it, really. And then as that goes on, you just normalise it even more and more.
Yeah, and it sounds like with you coming from at least a schooling background, so different to that.
Yeah, yeah.
Your kind of natural, like, personality inclination was to jump right in, see all these new things.
Literally.
And, you know, want to get involved. But then you didn't have the experience to know
to understand
how to stay safe and maybe you shouldn't be getting involved.
Literally no street smarts. Like, I had common sense just about.
Yeah.
But going in, you know, I got robbed when I was, I think, 13, 14 for the first time. And somebody rang me up for, you know, I was selling weed at the time. I said for 3 or 4 scores for 20 bags. And anybody who knows, well, why? Because the person sounded older and they said they were with an older friend. So if someone's older, they don't get 3 or 4 20 bags, you get a queue or a half of things. But at the time, I didn't know. And I went there and they were actually, funnily enough, they were really nice about it. They were just like, sorry, you know, it's just, we've been told by this person to do this. You shouldn't really be doing this in this area. Like, I'm like, it's my estate, mate. It's where I fucking live. Like, he's like, oh, yeah. Funnily enough.
Sounds like a very polite robbery.
It was a very polite robbery, but I knew the two of them by name and nature, and it could have gone a lot worse kind of thing. I think just whereas I've always had the gift of the gab. If I went back with my consciousness now, I'd be able to get them to give me my drawback. Like, it's cool, man. This is smoke. Who was it that sent you? British? Fuck British, man. Cool. I'll get my brother to ring him again. Right? Well, then, funnily enough, though, the two of them I knew. And then one of them actually ended up at one of my raves that I was putting on when I was about 18. And he asked for the mic. And I was like, I know you from somewhere. He was like, huh? I was like, you from Forest Gate? And he was like, yeah. I was like, what's your name? He's like, Kieran. Yeah, you robbed me when I was 13. And then in the same instance, within a few years of that, I'm cool with this guy now. Like, literally, he's a completely different person.
And so for you, when you first got involved with drugs, were you using them straight away?
Pretty much, yeah. Because it's that whole literally diving in of... Mm-hmm. of anything. Like, I was, you ever seen the movie Yes Man with Jim Carrey? Yeah, that was me at 13. Like, what's that? Who's that? It was an experience thing. It was like I wanted to try it all, and then the whole kind of like gang related stuff. It's a man thing, isn't it, when you're that age? Like 10, 20 years ago, they had football firms, they had all of that. But when you're however old I was in 2005, 2006, 13, you know, and you're living in that environment of, you know, we weren't road men back then, people. We just called them rude boys. Like, and, you know, you're living in the environment of rude boys and different cultures and different... I feel like I had this huge curtain up what London was, what my environment was. And then, like, as soon as I went into secondary school, it was like, da-da, you see all the lights and the cars and everything that actually makes it up.
Yeah, and you start seeing cars slowing down at certain places. Yeah. And you start knowing what's actually going on.
Yeah, literally. And all the, you know, the things that surround that as well, yeah. Like... But I don't know, I don't really know what it took me to stop, to be honest. I think it was one of those things that throughout the years, because I was a big click jumper, even though my story so far, I'd be at the back of the field smoking. I only did that 2-3 times a week. I'd be going to play basketball with other people. I'd go like, I feel like I knew almost everyone in my year and the surrounding years. So in the same respect, like, there's a positive side of being so ecstatic and manic that you do try everything. It means you do try everything. Like, it wasn't just the negative stuff that, in hindsight, has actually made me into the person I am. It's a lot of what my lyrics are based on. It's a lot of what myself is based on. But it's also, you know, chilling with the kind of skater kids and the, you know, the preppy kids and all of that. Like, I got that experience as well.
Yeah, you got really into the social side of the school because you were going around and getting to know what everyone else was up to.
Because I knew no one.
At what point did you start realising the, you know, the downsides of that? Was it when you got robbed, or were there experiences before?
I think it was a combination of things. And I think you learn deeper truths to lessons that you already know every single day. Like, even now at 26, you know, I'm still learning. I knew that one. No, there's little bits to it that you still didn't know. But in answer to your question, it's a progressive thing. Maybe 16, 17, and I started seeing it. Because by then I was in squat raves, I was in warehouse raves. I was kind of like left groups of people behind me because people would, you know, ring certain times, and then houses got raided and like bits and bobs happened, you know, and I was just sick of it all. You get to about 16, 17 and I kind of went into raving, but I still had the same, you know, big man attitude, the same I'm from the streets, I did this, even though I went to a Catholic all boys school.
But also, I think that plays into what you mentioned of it being a partly male thing, mm-hmm. that we do have this certain expectation to have some of that bravado.
Yeah.
So whether you actually have the background to back it up or not...
doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're still going to present in that way. Yeah. You know, and I see it even in, like, small ways, how friend groups of guys... as they grow older, their walks start to change.
Yeah.
They all start adopting this really like heavy shoulder way of walking around.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was there doing that too. But as an outsider, you're like, what are you guys doing? You're like 5 foot. You're not even fully grown. Like, everybody thinks you're hard walking like that.
Yeah. it's a funny old walk, isn't it? And I'm all for standing up straight. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I'm trying to get into that whole thing because I slouch a lot. But then they're standing up straight and pushing your shoulder. And then they're standing up straight and pushing your shoulder.
Yeah, there's a difference between good posture and like walking with your chest.
Yeah, quite literally, like looking like a fucking quail. Right? But yeah, no, I don't think it was anything specifically. I think it was then going into an environment outside of school and all the, you know, the things that surrounded it. Because it would always be after school, as one of my best mates would say, no matter what uniform you had on, when you went home and the trackies went on and you'd see other people, it's a different thing. You might load it from science class, you might do it there. But that's what I mean about the events surrounding school. But then when I went into a school...
So you'd kind of, by the sounds of it, built up like these parallel lives.
Pretty much, yeah.
It was you in your school uniform and then you out on the street.
Pretty much. And it was a weird thing because...
But then equally, you've got different expectations there. 100%. You know, you've got certain expectations academically that were being hopefully fed to some degree.
To some degree.
But, you know, there's being tough in school and there's being tough on the streets.
Yeah,
you were naturally kind of leaning into that by the sounds of it.
Yeah. It's fucking weird thinking about it in hindsight. Obviously, I have to take some responsibility for it, but at the same time, I'm a growing child. So I put a lot of it on the school system. Like, my best mate, his whole thing was he got kicked out when he was 8 and sent to a Peru. Think about it for a second. Kids get chucked out of schools. Like, fair enough, you come in your fucking school shooter. Yeah, sure enough. They don't just get kicked out, they get arrested. But there's a, like, my mate didn't have the greatest setup. Mainly the mother kind of side of things, which affects a young man, let's be real. And they both do, both parents do. But I think there's something about a mum like that does. And all that was ever needed of that young 11, 12-year-old was to be sat down and be like, what's wrong? Why are you angry? Why are you like, why are you throwing, nobody ever asks or doesn't ask in the right tone or in the right way why you would throw the chair or why you would start a fight or things like that. And I think it just comes down to the way that our education system is kind of set up and the whole infrastructure is set up, because the education system mirrors the rest of society and how that is.
It's certainly interesting to me what you mentioned about how your friend's life and like stability was so influenced by the lack of a mum being around, or you know, lack of a mum being around who was able to be supportive in the way that he needed. Because I think certainly for young men, we naturally look for male role models in a way that we don't with
and then
women.
What's he find on the street?
Yeah,
he found somebody who taught him how to sell things and break bike locks, and
yeah.
Then fast forward to now, and I've kept him out of prison for about, well, I haven't. He has kept himself out of prison, but I've aided. Well, it just takes one slip, and he's there. And it's set up for young black males to kind of just slip back into it as well, like, which sucks. But, you know, as is life, and you've got to roll with punches, I guess.
And so at what point through all of this were you becoming aware of, like, anxiety in yourself or anxiety symptoms?
I think the first time I spoke to Spliff, maybe didn't have a panic attack, but I lost control of myself. I like would kind of go back into my brain, and all I'd be doing was thinking, like deeply thinking though, for a couple of minutes, and then I'd come back and I'd be like, Johnny, oh mate, you know, I've in my head, I haven't been able to speak for 3-4 minutes, and you know, all it was as I said, just me thinking. That was the first level of anxiousness I ever felt. Like, everyone feels some varying levels of anxiety, but maybe they might not know what it is. But that was like, oh, I'm going into this party now and I'm going to be high for the first time. And that, I think that was the literal first time that I can remember anyway, that, you know, I felt anxious, but I didn't know what it was. I was still probably 14, 15, something like that. I still wasn't sure what exactly it was. And I don't think I even heard the term anxiety till I was about 18 or so. It got more thrown about, or maybe it's just the way the world was. You know, the world got to that level where there was fuck loads of it, and it just came to my attention at the time.
Yeah, so as far as you were concerned, you just had these times when you were really in your head and even would struggle to speak at times, but you didn't have any word for that?
That introduced me to deep thinking on a level that I hadn't really done before, and I think that's what it was. Not just thinking about all the nice things, you think about all the nasty things. But then when I grew up a bit more, we had the discussions, you know, as you grow older, you realise that it does help. Like, it does help to just to talk about it. I think the lack of communication in the world is where we're failing. It kind of grew as I got older. Like, when I started moving out, I then found my adrenaline or my whatever it was that I was looking for. But I'd say it's my teenagehood. I found, you know, what I needed to keep me going was in raves, I guess, like warehouse raves. I don't know if anybody can remember their first rave, but if you think about it for a second, it was actually nuts. It was like walking into a circus. And I really delved myself into that. But then what ended up happening was, even though I was learning it all and I was like, oh, this is what maybe I'd want to make a career out of, is because it was so ungoverned, all these other things started creeping back in, like, oh, we just lost this much, Amanda. Da, da, da. She got held up by a knife and rare tear, tear. And like, you know, these are, I was going through a very confusing time in my life in terms
of. Yeah, because you'd seen this thing that you were getting the adrenaline hit out of, but it felt a bit safer. It felt like progress
for
you as a young person. and yet all the same kind of activity is still happening.
Yeah, because, literally.
You know, it's kind of like one thing being illegal just naturally seems to attract more.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, actually. But there's one thing having a bar set up, but people know it's not just a bar set up. There's three or four drug dealers, you know, posted about it. There's people selling NOS. And then when that becomes a more of a, I hate to use the word community here, but it is, because there's actually lack of community, but, and people start to know each other, then they are the big dogs. And it's, again, going back to an alpha male ego kind of thing, and it's going back to a territorial kind of thing, because that's where people get robbed. They'd be like,
and I imagine you then started to feel the pressure to be like, oh, should I be getting cut in on certain things given I'm meant to be in charge?
Like, I'm just a kid who would put wires in and sometimes get on the mic, and but I'd still have half a gram of whatever and, you know, half an ounce of whatever as well, like in my pocket to be there, but on my own. Like, I didn't do this with anybody anymore. And then, yeah, exactly that. I'm like, do I get in with Tommy Tucker and all these other people? Do I, like, try and run these? And I'd be a completely different person now. If I'm still running Scott raves at 26, like, probably smoke crack by now. Like, so I was quite happy I stuck with the group of friends and realised, have the same mistake and be like...
Yeah, but equally I could see how you could have gone down that path very easily. It was there.
Open.
It was an option the whole time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To contrast it slightly with schooling experience and how different that is, I certainly experienced it where everything was so geared towards university.
Yeah, that was
the whole thing. And so for me, it was really surreal to be like getting pressured into university when I already had a job.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to push this thing of, you need this to get a job. And I was like, but no, that's not my reality. And equally, you know, in a different way, you already were out earning. It was in a sociable way, you were enjoying, you were getting to know
people. I'm still learning.
And you knew everyone because of that.
Yeah.
Then the idea of like going into further education or a conventional job.
Yeah.
How was that going to appeal to you?
It didn't. it was very, very foreign to me. I didn't really get involved even thinking about university until I was about 22, 23. And that was just due to the fact of how lax the uni was. Like, it was this little community centre in Whitechapel that was like, it was under, all the studios were underneath the community centre. I will always be shouting out CM Community Music. Like, they weren't a uni to me. They were just like a little outlet where I could go, and I, you know, had all these fucked up shit happen to me, and you know, where everyone else fucked off to uni, and I was just like, oh, trying to navigate life. It was just that little booster I need, because I was already heavily involved in the industry. So it was more the production, and because it was a music production and business course, but it was more the production side of it. But then there was a little bits of business, like the law, and there was little bits that you still don't know, and like it was very useful. But yeah, between that period, I think it got the worst it's ever been for not just mental health, just for life in general. That 17 to 18 period where everybody had kind of, I got kicked out of sixth form, then went to a college and got kicked out of that, then went to another college. But then at the same time, I'd been running this label and it was doing okay and it was getting some traction, and there was some order and structure in my life there, but there was so much chaos surrounding it. You know, I'd stopped going to Scott raves as much because, you know, you get to see 7 a.m. enough and smell crack pipes and wanted to leave enough times that you're like, I'm 19 now, I can get into actual events, I should probably stop going to these. It was a good earner, but, you know, it's not worth almost risking your life or almost losing your life, rather. But 18 was a very prominent, the label was going really well. It was starting off really well. We had this big event in January with all these little events promoting it. And it was just the excess of the amount of drugs I took, maybe, but I got to, can't even remember exactly when it happened, but I basically had a psychotic episode. I spent a whole week thinking I wasn't in reality. I think it was the mixture of everything. So I think it's a big thing, and it needs to be taught. We should have more control over drugs. We should look at Portugal as a great example, because they have done amazing things with it. And I don't think that me or anybody else who suffered not having to, that sounds like very childish, very bratty, but wanting to and doing that, you know, and delving myself into that culture so much that I took so much that one day I just woke up, I'm not in reality now, I'm...
And you didn't have the context for any of what you were going through. And I think that's a big problem with the drugs approach in this country, that the whole narrative is about just never take them and you'll be fine. But then actually, the people that listen to that are probably mainly the ones that are never going to take them in the first place.
Pretty much.
There's going to be certain people that just get exposed to it. I can't see how you wouldn't have been. Even if you'd somehow not gone near it, you would have, you know, inhaled somebody else's, or you would have, spiked or something. You know, any number of things could have happened.
Yeah.
And then where's the advice for after that happens? After you've taken something, if you fall into addiction, where's the support? Where's the narrative? Where's the education there?
And it's there, but it's not. Like, it's not there like it is now. Like, and even now, it's still got a long, long way to come. And at the time, there were Samaritans and there were things like that. But you're an 18, 19-year-old kid. I'm like, I don't think I'm in reality. Why is calling up Samaritans? And I didn't know about Mind or any of the other, you know, great things that are there. But it's maybe it needed to be more accessible and it needed to be more there from early. You need to be taught about drugs, not just these are all the drugs and don't do them. Like, you need to be really taught. I think the drug screening tests and festivals, I think they're really good. It sounds silly. It sounds like they shouldn't. But if you actually think about it, what if there is heroin in that pill?
Yeah, so if the listeners don't know what that is, a lot of festivals now give out drug testing kits.
Mm-hmm.
Because as much as they fight to keep the drugs out of the festivals, there's always stuff that gets in. Mm-hmm. And so the approach is, well, it's going to be here anyway. If we give these testing kits to people, they can check what's actually in what they've purchased.
Yeah.
And then, you know, actually have informed consent. But also, I mean, from a healthcare perspective as well, then they know what they've got. If something happens, they need to go in an ambulance. They at least know
what is in them. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and they don't. And that's the thing with being a doctor is you need to, because you think it's something else or something else, and then you prescribe for that. Boom.
Yeah, you know. Because ultimately, a lot of the approach from the doctors may be just giving them more drugs.
Yep.
And it doesn't matter whether it's a good, you know, what's considered a good drug or a bad drug. There's side effects, there's reactions to all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so it's funny, old world. It took me about a week. I was there for a week, and anybody who was there, I love you. It was fucking hard. And I remember quite clearly some of the conversations I had. My parents knew about it as well, like to some degree. And my great-grandmother was in hospital at the time. It was an amalgamation of things. It wasn't just the drugs. It was the fact that I'm 18, 19. All my mates in uni. And the majority of the friends that might be still in London are too busy, you know, caught up in something I don't want to be caught up in anymore. So I was a bit lost, but always been very, very sociable. But I was just not... I was just getting fucked up, like, literally, to deal with it, to escape it, to not have to think about it, to not be in that mindset. And then, ironically, what my mind must have done was, like, no.
Well, it sounds like you got so used to using recreationally and socially that then when actually the social side went away, not only did you not quite know why you're still doing it other than to escape, but you also, you've kind of lost perspective because you don't know what you feeling normal even is anymore.
Pretty much. Like, sober wasn't sober. Like, normality
you'd think was something was sober and you're actually not. So you'd take more. And actually, you weren't sober at any point.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's what my mind must have done, was like, I'm confused. I'm in a developing mind and body, and now putting it under so much stress of chemically speaking and psychologically speaking, that it did just go, right, you've literally escaped now. Like, you're not there. And it took a load of conversations. I still took drugs over that period as well, which is crazy, like, to think about. And it was around Halloween as well. Like, I think it started on, like, the 28th, and then it went to the 5th or something like that. So it's always a very weird time of the year when I'm like, oh, it's like an anniversary of my craziness. Like, but I remember we went out to a rave. My mate's older brother was DJing, and I still took a pill. Like, it's the weirdest thing, like, in hindsight, to be like, I have, like, obviously I didn't know it all. I didn't know that I'd gone into this psychotic episode because I took all them drugs. Like, I don't know, it was a weird thing.
Yeah, you didn't identify it as a breakdown, but again, you didn't have the language and the knowledge around that.
Yeah, there was
so
no
So you just felt more out of it than normal, but then if you're used to taking drugs,
I've got to take
a certain amount of being out of it is then normal to you.
Yeah, literally. And that wasn't even the clincher. Like, it took a few more days, a few more conversations, and a few more reflections in my own head to wake up that literally it was 7 days as well. It was like a week later, and then go, the fuck have I been doing? I think that was my first proper, like, this is how real shit can get if you don't look after your mental health.
Yeah.
Like, it was very much like, yeah, stop smoking. Like, and I did. I didn't smoke for a good few months after that, a good 5-6 months. I need to kind of step away. And it was good. I could focus on the music, the label, and that went all really, really well. We played in Cable, which was in London Bridge, and that was all good, and everything was all going nice. So it kind of, I learned from it a lot. Mm-hmm. Like...
And how long after all of that did you then start getting support?
Well, around that time, I went to counselling and I did all the counselling, six sessions, and I did, and went from, I can't remember what it was,
CBT.
CBT, and then I got referred to like private, basically. They said, oh, you know, you want to continue? And I got diagnosed and I just weren't having it. I was just like, no, you're lying. She was like, well, you show a lot of symptoms towards it. And I was like, nah, just got up and left. And never really went to counselling till literally last Wednesday. I worked for Mind for a bit, for mental health charity. So I had learned a bit about Mind because I was telling people a bit about Mind. So I had that line. So anytime I felt close in my young adult life to an attempt or some thought, I had somebody to ring. Like, I had friends anyway, but professionals always got that exact thing to say, even though if it could be cliche, it's what you want to hear at the time. So I had that, and I was more aware of it, and being an advocate for talking about it as well made more people want to talk about it with me and tell me other things. But it made me really and truly like want to like make a change with it. I'd gone through this stuff, and I just was like, I don't want people to go through the same shit, or at least not go through the same shit and not have any form of help, really.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me there that you went to such different extremes, that you started off not accepting the diagnosis at all,
mm-hmm.
and resisting that, to then being in a place where you're advocating for other people to do what you'd struggled with.
Yeah, you're right. Facebook status is about, like, you know, running away from things and stuff, and would say it, but I'd never identify it. I never really fully identified it, I feel like. I knew what it was. I knew it was like, it was a coping mechanism, but I didn't know it was escapism.
And I think that's why that's the tipping point for a lot of people, because as long as you're, you know, hiding from that truth, you can also hide from the fact that this coping mechanism isn't working.
Yeah.
Like, if you never acknowledge the reason you're doing it, you'll never acknowledge that it's not working.
And that's when I stopped and I was like, nope, I'm done now. You look 7 to 10 years in the face. And you just, and like the possibility of not being able to tour in certain countries and continents, and you're like, nah.
But it also sounds like that was a moment of acceptance that you'd been working up to.
Pretty much. And I was like, it wasn't just that, that for me was like, you fucking idiot. And it was like everything, all the dominoes went, blah. You really see for a second, like, it's not just the money that I'd be earning from that. It's not just the image of the male selling drugs and wee. It was like, I wanted that, like, I wanted that adrenaline, I wanted that money, and I wanted that, and I need to want something else or another way to get it. Like, it's quite simple, because that's too dangerous. And it's like, it gets to that point when it's family and close friends, and you like, you've literally ruined relationships because you wanted a bit of profit and you wanted to feed their addiction. And yeah, they could have got it elsewhere, but they didn't, they got it from me. It was tough, man. Like, and I think that's the hardest one to deal with.
Also, with you experiencing a condition like cyclothymia, to me at least, it makes a lot of sense that you were using substances that would add to the high that can come with that.
So if
people aren't as familiar with that condition, it often is referred to as like the little cousin of bipolar. It can't be as severe, but just that the highs and lows tend to cycle through faster and be, yes, less predictable. And so with that, it makes a lot of sense that if you're in a manic phase, then you're going to be doing everything you can to kind of ride that wave. And then on the flip side, if you're in a depressive phase, it's like, what can I possibly do quickly to get me out of that?
Either or. Like, it's literally, like, the answer is always drugs. Like, that's the thing with escapism, is it doesn't matter how happy you are, how sad you are. And it took a lot of reading, it took a lot of meditation, it took a lot of yoga, it took a lot of finding other bits and bobs to realise how I can deal with my issues. And now, when I do actually look after myself, it took a lot of routine, it took a lot of, you know, wiping off my whiteboard every week and developing this little point system I have where I score certain points for reading every day and doing yoga every day. And it just, diligence, man, just complete self-discipline for me to be able to sit here and go, you know, I don't remember the last time I went on a sesh, so to speak. Yeah. Right? Can't remember. And I'm almost quite proud of that, to be honest. Like,
yeah, you should be, absolutely.
And even when people do have it, and it gets to 11, 12 o'clock, to now be able to just be like, I'm just going home, mate. Like, I just feel like, yes, somewhat adult Xbox achievement. Like.
And did you find you needed to kind of replace that high with something else? Was it like getting into your music more? You found a different kind of adrenaline?
To a degree, yeah. I think it was about enjoying the industry without having to go into the green room and be like, oh, do you want a little bump? Do you want a little smoke? Like,
you got to a place where you were more invested in reality.
Yeah, that's a good way to
phrase it.
Yeah, literally. Like, rather than the actual escape itself and cutting out all that and then just having that all, the same thing, just with life, instead of like, how long can I enjoy this conversation that I'm having with someone?
It sounds like it was your determination to recover and to change things that
got
you through
all.
You know, that you had to create a whole routine in lieu of, by the sound of it, you ever having one.
You had to really
take ownership of
it. It's self-discipline, and it's something I talk about through my music. I think that's why I staggered on that question. I've got a lot of ethoses, a lot of sayings, but one of them that got me through anxiety, and to this day when I have any anxiety attacks in public, is they don't think you think what they think. That's probably my best one. That stopped every single panic attack that I've had in the last few years, pretty much. It relates to what, you know, you want, you think your parents want you to be this, and really at the end of the day, they just want you to be happy and safe.
And ultimately, I think when we drill down in ourselves, that's what we want as well.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, all your ambition, all your achievements, it ultimately comes down to you want to get to a place in your life where you feel happy and safe.
Or free, to some degree, I guess.
Yeah. We'll wrap up there then. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. If people want to learn more about you, where should they look online?
My Instagram is Everybody Loves Fate. So, you know, that old Everybody Loves Chris program, just take out Chris and put F-A-T-E in there instead. My socials are that pretty much across SoundCloud, YouTube. I think my main thing with socials online is obviously putting out my music, but I put a story up every day. And I say this little quote, and I've had loads of people say, you know, been helping them a little bit. But the quote is basically, it gets easier. Every day it gets a little bit easier, but you've got to do it every day. And that's the hard part, but it does get easier. And for any BoJack Horseman fans, that's actually the last line that was said in season 2. But yeah.
I thought that sounded familiar.
Yeah. But I really gravitated to it. And like I said, it's one of those ethoses that I have. But it's something you can catch me on Instagram saying every day.
Right. All right, I'll put a link for your Instagram in the description.
Love that.
And that's everything. Thanks again for being on the show.
Sweet, man. Cheers. Lovely to be here.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.